You are listening to The Point from MC3 in Lewistown, Pennsylvania. Check us out on the web at mc3church.org or find us on Facebook at mc3church. MC3, it's like nothing you'd expect.
After God.
How many of you have ever been to a wedding? You can raise your hand, we're participating. Last week I realized I should have had you participate some more, but jumping up and down on your chairs, but I'll let it go. But at a wedding, if you've ever been to one, which many of you have, there is a spot during the reception, a place, a physical location where the bride and groom and the wedding party sit. And if the wedding party is nice, they let the wedding party sit with maybe also someone that they actually care about and didn't just meet last night at the rehearsal dinner. But there's this place, and what do we call that place? The what? The head table. Right, the head table, because the head table is the place of honor. And usually, if the caterer knows what they're doing, usually the head table gets served first. Because that is the location, that is the point of honor, that is that's why you're there, to see the bride and groom, and to be a part of what is going on in their life. And so the head table is reserved for those special people. And one of the things that has been kind of fun, actually I really like it this way, honestly. And so if you're considering getting married, what I'm about to say, do not do this, okay? But I am not asked, as the officiant, as the pastor leading the ceremony, I am often not asked to be at the head table. And that is because it's not about me. It's not my day. It's about the bride and groom. And even one of the things that I've gotten really good at, and I think I've shared this with you before, is what I call the wedding lean. And that is this. Because what usually happens before the wedding lean is you may kiss your bride. And then I go like that. Because no one wants me going in the back of the picture while the bride and groom are kissing. So I've learned the lean to try to get out of the scene so that I'm not in that picture. But I am not the focus, and the head table is the place of honor. And I don't know if you've ever been invited to be a part of the head table. We went to a banquet, actually the Forward Edge banquet. Justin last week just shared, we sponsored a table there as a church. And where they were able to raise more money than ever to continue to support the ministries, including Trigo y Miel, the feeding program that we as a church partner with in Oaxaca, Mexico. But we went to that banquet a number of years ago. We were invited. They paid for us to come because of all the partnerships. So sorry, I got a perk that you didn't get to enjoy. But because of your giving, I got to go to Portland and take my wife with me, and we got a hotel. And I remember I was actually part of the program there, and when we had a little rehearsal for the program, they said, and this is your table, this is where you're going to sit when it's done, and it was right up front, not in the on the platform, but right up front of everyone, and is where the speaker was, and kind of all the important people were there, and we're kind of like, why are we here? We were seated in a place of honor. We were brought to the head table. And when I was in I don't even know how old we were. I don't even know if you were a part of this story. My brother Nick is here, you can recognize him as the guy that looks like me with hair, except the hair has moved from here to here. But when we were younger, my dad, I don't even know how it came about, but my dad got tickets to this brand new stadium called Camden Yards, which is where the Baltimore Orioles had played. They still play there. And it was like a refurbished warehouse. It was really cool looking stuff. But he was given tickets to this baseball game. Did you go with us then? So, okay, you were younger. It didn't matter. You didn't count. But we got these tickets, and I think it was me and my dad. I don't know who else. Maybe mom was with me. I don't know. Everybody that they love. And I remember we're driving up, and there's this, I don't know if you've ever been to a sporting event, especially a professional sporting event, even Penn State, you've got this lines and lines of traffic leading up to the stadium, to the venue, and there were lines of traffic, and literally on like the highway, there was a sign, like usually where it says exit 107 or something, it actually said, gold pass holders, this lane. And my dad was like, the guy mentioned something, and he pulls out the envelope that the tickets were in, and it said gold pass. And it says, hang this on your mirror. We hung it on our mirror, and all of a sudden, bloop, We were in the gold pass holders lane. Guess what? No line. Not at all. We didn't have to wait to drive. We went right up. And then we're like parking, like we're parking like, oh, I hope they don't hit a home run close to the field or a foul ball because it would hit our car. And we're right there, and we're like, wow, this is really cool. We were just given these tickets. And then we get into, you know, we walk into the stadium and get up to the, you know, the concourse level. And they're like, you know, can I see your tickets? You know, where are you supposed to be? And we're like, I don't know, here. And we gave them to a guy, and he's like, oh, right this way. So he kind of walks us over and then hands them to this dude that's got like, I don't know if chaps is the word, but he's got these like puffy pants, and he's got the old classic like golf. He looks like a golfer. An old golfer, not a new golfer, an old golfer. And it's got that special hat on, and it's looking all retro. Of course, that was, I don't know if they still do that, but that was like the flair of Camden Yards. It's the classic baseball stadium. And this guy says, right this way. And he takes us, and, you know, kind of like, okay, wow, we're not going up, we're going down. And he takes us down, like there's some rows here, like, oh, this is really cool, Dad, look at these seats, this is great. And he's like, yeah, I know, you know. And he's going down, and he's like, we're still going. And he keeps walking forward more. And we're like, okay, this is awesome. Like, okay, we're like in the fourth row. We're like, no, keeps going. And like there's the dugout. Then there's this boxed off section of seats. And he says, right this way. And walks us into the boxed off section of seats. We are at like, what do you call it? I don't want to say 50-yard line, but you're at the, you know, things that happen in baseball, like it's meaningless. But it was cool to be there. We were there, and we were, so he says, right there, and we're, like, there are actually, like there's a not a rope, but like a pole kind of thing kind of keeping us from the regulars. And, you know, and so we go there. And then the dude, right, he's like, these are your seats. And he places, you know, have the seats kind of fold up. He puts the seat down. And then, I don't know where, he whips out a broomy dealy thing and goes, here you go, sir. And that was our seats, and we're like, what in the world? This is crazy. And it was just a guy saying, yeah, I have some extra seats, do you want to go? And my dad's like, sure, that sounds like fun. And so here we were, taken from hello to right this way, sir. Here's your seat, sir. We didn't do anything to earn it. We didn't do anything to deserve it. I feel like there's a song about that. And all of a sudden, here we were, undeserved, in these amazing seats. And today I want to tell you a story, as we continue the life of David, how David invited someone to be a part of his head table, of his royal, kingly table. You have to say royal that way. You have to roll it. If you can't do it, you can't say the word. Sorry. It's a rule. But he invites someone who doesn't deserve it to be a part of his table, and I'm going to talk with you about that. And the point that's going to come through all of this is this. When you're after God, your life is marked by undeserved grace. Now, to be clear, first of all, undeserved grace is redundant. Because grace means there is nothing that we can do to deserve it. There is nothing we can do to earn it. But I just wanted to put that in there so that we really get it. Like, we don't deserve it. We did not deserve these seats in these box section of Camden Yards. We did not deserve the main table at the front of the banquet. There was nothing we did. There's nothing we could do to earn it. We did not deserve it. But when we are after God, your life is marked by undeserved grace. And we've been going through this series. Now we're on our second month of it. It's only 2 months. And looking at the life of David, who at this point in our story is King David. And he was called, before we even got into his story, God said, I have picked out a man after my own heart. He was a man after God's own heart. And so this idea of what does it look like to be a person after God's own heart? And again, this is available at mc3church.org. If you click on listen to the point, you can listen to it. Or just go to mc3church.org/after God because we're telling the story here. And so it's kind of, you're going to be picking up in the middle if you haven't been here for the last couple of weeks. But I think that'll be okay. But if you want to kind of fill in the rest of the story up to this point, you can certainly go there. But I want to talk about this idea of being receiving undeserved grace. So before we get into that story, I want to catch you up a little bit more. There's some intervening chapters that we need to follow. Last week we ended with David worshiping with all of his might before the Lord, bringing the ark back to Jerusalem, because now he made Jerusalem the capital. He is the king, and again, I'm not going to take time to get into that, but he is now the king over all of Israel. He is celebrating the fact that he is there and bringing the ark, which is a symbol of God's presence, to the tabernacle set up in the capital of Jerusalem. And he's worshiping God with everything, and Kirk alluded to it in his prayer this morning. Even this idea of, you know, it doesn't matter what people think. It doesn't matter about our circumstances. We need to worship God with everything we've got. And that's what David did. And so at the end of that chapter, we pick up on a couple of things where now the kingdom, things are starting to settle in. And I'll just say this as a little bit of a teaser slash spoiler. When things start to calm down, then it gets really dangerous. Because we think, and again, this is free, this is bonus, this isn't even tied to what we're talking about today. When we think that, oh, everything's so awful, I'm in such a hard spot right now, I have to trust God with everything, and God, I'm praying more than I ever need to, and I'm just spending time talking to other people, and I just really need God's help, and things are rough, and this sucks, God, fix it, make it better. And what we don't realize is that in those moments, we are praying more. We are dependent on God. We are spending time getting what we need from Him and from His community of believers around Him. But when things start to calm down, like, oh, things are good now. And then suddenly God loses his place in the picture. But that's a little spoiler for next week. Sorry, David is not perfect. But this week, there's some things that happen. And there's one of the most beautiful passages that I can't just bounce over. It's what we call the Davidic covenant. The Davidic covenant is a very fancy, fancy term for a covenant for David. A covenant is a promise. A covenant is a guarantee. And the Bible is full of promises that God makes to people. And we're not going to get into all of them. There's the Mosaic covenant. There was a Noahic covenant. You know what that covenant was? It was called the rainbow. And God says, I hereby promise never to destroy the earth by a flood again. Boom, rainbow in the sky is a symbol of my covenant, my promise. So he makes a covenant. God makes a covenant with David. And this is important just for Christmas. And even more important for Easter. But this is the covenant, and we're just going to kind of skip through it. Basically, God comes to David and says, David, here's what I want you to know. And he speaks through Nathan the prophet. And Nathan, remember that name, because he's going to be a little bit important in, say, a few more weeks here. But he comes to Nathan, and he speaks through Nathan to David. And just giving you the gist of it, God makes a promise to David. And it is what is called an unconditional, also known as unilateral covenant, meaning David actually has nothing to do with what's going to happen here. God says, this will happen, David. This is going to be the way it is. If you screw it up, David, you know what? It doesn't matter, because I am a God of grace, and I'm going to do it anyway. And we're still not even what we're talking about today. But the Davidic covenant, and I just want to read this to you because it's kind of important to a whole lot of stuff. If you remember, 4 or 5 weeks ago now, there was this guy, his name was Samuel, and God sent him to anoint, to set apart the next person that would be the next king. This person after God's own heart. The guy's name was David. But he sent Samuel to a little town of Bethlehem, because that's where David was from. So God makes this promise with David. And this is what he says, just in the middle of chapter 7. You can read it on your own. It's in the Bible. It's free. And it's, you can get a YouVersion app if you have it there. You can go there. The lights are on too, actually, if you want to look at paper, you know, for old people, like abacuses and coffee. Thank you there, ATU. So this is what God says. Furthermore, the Lord declares that he will make a house for you, a dynasty of kings. He says, David, God is going to make a line. You are going to be the beginning of a long line, a dynasty. And if you don't know what dynasty is, like, look it up. They're all over the world. You've got the Pharaoh dynasties of Ramses and Hatshepsut, and you've got all these different lines of the Caesars, and you've got the lines of the queens and kings of England and all that. I saw a headline yesterday. Oh, it's off the subject. I don't have time for that. Okay, so I've got to keep going. But the queen decided, oh, I'm not going to be the queen anymore, and she gave it to Meghan Markle, which, if you know anything about dynasty and kingly line and rule, that's not possible on so many levels. But she did it anyway. But it's on the supermarket, it said. So it must be true. He said, I'm going to make you a line, a house for you. And when you die and are buried with your ancestors, now listen to this, I will raise up one of your descendants, your own offspring, and I will make his kingdom strong. Now, there's a double thing going on here. He's talking about his child. His name's, well, spoiler, Solomon. And he said, he's going to build the house, the temple for my name. His son Solomon is going to build the temple. He says, and then I will secure his royal throne forever. And this will tie in a little bit later, so I'll just kind of leave it there. But the idea that this line, he is going to be a king forever. And that's not the way kings worked. Like, you wanted your family and your line and your descendants and descendants and descendants to be kings and queens forever. But typically someone came along and went, and killed them and killed everyone else in the family. And so that was the end of the line. That happened all the time. And again, if you read through your history, rarely do you see a line. I mean, I don't know what the length, aside from David, I don't know what like the longest reign of multiple families in one king is. But I'm going to go with, I'm just throwing a number out, maybe a dozen, maybe. Maybe you see a dozen before someone kills someone, cuts off the line and starts over. And then someone else will be like the king for like 10 minutes and then they kill them. But he says, I'm going to make one forever. He says, I will be his father. He will be my son. If he sins, I will correct and discipline him with the rod like any father would do. But my favor will not be taken from him as I took it from Saul. Now, again, we know Saul, God said, no, I'm done with him. He disobeyed. Now David is going to be the new king. He says, your house and your kingdom will continue before me for all time, and your throne will be forever. You may have heard it at, say, December, and he shall reign forever and ever. Hallelujah, hallelujah. I don't do that part because that's too high. Because there's a song about this idea that there's going to be a king who will reign forever and ever. And if you were here like 4 years ago when we did the many jacked up generations in Jesus genealogy, a Christmas tale, you heard us talk about how Jesus was descended from David. And so this is the promise here that God says, David, one day there is going to be someone in the line, in your family line, and he's going to come from this little town where David came from, and he is going to be ruler of all. And that's why, I mean, I don't have time. You need to go to the Many Jacked Up Generations in Jesus Genealogy. If you find that on our website, mc3church.org, we talked all about how this line continues, and there's Jesus on the scene. And we're going to see, actually, in a couple of months, we're doing a series called Extras. Part one is in December, and you're going to hear about why was Herod all upset about this king that people are talking about? Who's the one born king of the Jews? Like, Herod's like, what? I'm the king. What are you talking about? Spoiler, we'll get there. So this is a covenant, a promise that God made to David. And it has nothing really to do with what we're talking about today, except for the fact that it's kind of a big deal. It kind of affects a whole lot of things. So just so you're aware of that, when it comes time later and you start hearing some of these things about the one who is the ruler, the Messiah, the anointed one who is to come in the line of David, now you know why. Because God made a promise to David. Well, at that point, 17, probably about 1,500 years before Jesus comes on the scene, give or take. And so then that's the first thing. The second thing, just to make it quickly, is the Davidic conquest. Now, at this point, now things are really settling down. David, like all the big people that were fighting against the kingdom of Israel, is just, no, they're David is in charge. There's no tension, there's no problems. And there's little spats and battles and problems here and there. But, you know, there isn't this all-out war. Things are starting to calm down a little bit. And that's what 2 Samuel 8 is all about. Which brings us to 2 Samuel 9. And again, just to remind you of the point now, to get you back into the story. When you're after God, your life is marked by undeserved grace. So I'm going to read this passage, and then I'll come back and talk about it. If you have a Bible, if you have YouVersion, we're going to be in 2 Samuel chapter 9. And if you have the free YouVersion app, which you might actually need for this station afterwards, which I'll get to that in a moment or later. But if you tap on Old Testament, tap on 2 Samuel, tap on 9. You can tap on 1 because we're going to be in verse 1 here and following through the whole passage. I'm going to read it and come back. He says that one day David asked, is anyone in Saul's family still alive? Anyone to whom I can show kindness for Jonathan's sake? I'm going to stop right there. Even though I said I wouldn't. I have this highlighted because I want you to know something. A couple of weeks back, when we were talking about David fleeing from Saul in the wilderness, and we said it that week, when you're after God, you know, you can hide in the shadow of his wings. God has got you there. And in the middle of that, I referred to this little blurb about how David and Jonathan, who were really, really close friends, Jonathan was the son of King Saul, and basically Jonathan went to his dad and said, Dad, why are you trying to kill David? And he's like, I'm not! And then he tried to kill his son, too, because he talked about David. And so clearly, Saul was not happy about David, trying to kill him. And again, you have to listen to that to get more of the detail. But in the middle, Jonathan is like, David, I know God is with you, and I know you're going to be the next king. And I know how it works with kings. When a king comes along, just in case they don't, just so no one else will come along and say, oh, the throne belongs to me, a king will kill everyone that is part of the family, the previous dynasty, the family of the previous throne. And he says, David, can you just promise, and this is the actual words here, I can tell you. He says, David, make a covenant with me. He says, don't ever cut off your kindness for my family. Not even when the Lord has cut off every one of your enemies from the face of the earth. And basically, David and Jonathan had an oath, a covenant together, that David said, look, Jonathan, we are friends. And I promise that I will not destroy, I will not hurt or harm your family when God brings me into my kingdom. And again, that was, at this point, probably 15 years earlier in the story of where we are now. So David says, is there anyone still alive? He remembers this promise. Is there anyone still out there that I can show kindness to? And this word kindness is a Hebrew word. It's chesed. And chesed is an amazing Hebrew word. The Old Testament was written in Hebrew. That's what they spoke. So they wrote that way. Oh, makes sense. And it's this chesed. It's this word. It means loving kindness or loyal love. The New Testament kind of translates it grace. It's, is there anyone that I can show undeserved favor? Is there anyone that is part of this line that I can show them just this loyal love, this loving kindness, this undeserved grace because I made this promise to Jonathan? So, now, I'm going to read the rest of the story and not interrupt. He summoned a man named Ziba. Who had been one of Saul's servants. Are you Ziba? The king asked. Yes, sir, I am, Ziba replied. The king then asked him, is anyone still alive from Saul's family? If so, I want to show God's chesed, God's kindness to them. Ziba replied, yes, one of Jonathan's sons is still alive. He is crippled in both feet. Where is he? The king asked. In Lo Debar, Ziba told him, at the home of Machir, son of Amamil. I don't know. Not chamomile. Okay, keep going. So David sent for him and brought him from Lo Debar, Machir's home. His name, now, it's been fun, I'm interrupting, being in Prime Group the last few weeks, you know, we have a lot of passages, we read the stories, and the names are kind of rough. Anyone want to take a stab at this one? It's actually pretty easy. It's Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth. So that's his name, and if I transpose some of the consonants, it's because it's a long word. Give me a break. His name was Mephibosheth. He was Jonathan's son and Saul's grandson. So Mephibosheth, Jonathan's son, Saul's grandson. When he came to David, he bowed low to the ground in deep respect. David said, greetings, Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth replied, I am your servant. Don't be afraid, David said. I intend to show you chesed to you because of my promise to your father, Jonathan. I will give you all the property that once belonged to your grandfather, Saul. And you will eat here with me at the king's table. Mephibosheth bowed respectfully and exclaimed, who is your servant that you would show such kindness to a dead dog like me? Then the king summoned Saul's servant Ziba and said, I have given your master's grandson everything that belonged to Saul and his family. You and your sons and servants are to farm the land for him to produce food for your master's household. But Mephibosheth, your master's grandson, will eat here at my table. Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. So he had the workforce to pull it off. Ziba replied, yes, my lord, the king, I am your servant, and I will do all that you have commanded. And from that time on, Mephibosheth ate regularly at David's table like one of the king's own sons. Mephibosheth had a young son named Micah. From then on, all the members of Ziba's household were Mephibosheth's servants. And Mephibosheth, who was crippled in both feet, lived in Jerusalem and ate regularly at the king's table. Mephibosheth is an incredible story of God's grace, of undeserved favor. And I'll just give you a little spoiler again. I'm all about, you know, keeping it all connected somehow. We're Mephibosheth. We are Mephibosheth. And as we tell the story, just think about you. Think about your Mephibosheth moments. But I probably wouldn't say that three times fast. Because Mephibosheth, he was invited to the table. And before you have the king's royal table with fancy silver plasticware, paper, I guess this is paper, and silver. But you have the king's table before you. And at this table today, there are five chairs. And I want to talk to you about each of these chairs at the king's table. And these are in no particular order, aside from the fact that they're in the order of the passage. But starting here, you've got a chair. This is the chair, for the outcasts. A seat for the outcasts. Because Mephibosheth represents five different things that you can see in his life. And honestly, those five things, probably one of them at least, fits our lives and fits where we are. And so at the table here, there's a seat for the outcasts. And this seat is welcoming to anybody that feels like they're out on their own, that they don't fit in, that they don't belong. Because David invited Mephibosheth to his table. And this is what we see here in verse 3. He says, the king then asked his servant Ziba, is anyone still alive from Saul's family? If so, I want to show God's kindness to them. Ziba replied, yes, one of Jonathan's sons is still alive. Now, what we need to remember, if you weren't here a few weeks ago, Jonathan and his dad Saul both died in battle. They were gone. And it seems at this point, which is, again, probably 7, maybe 8, 9, maybe 10 years later, that Mephibosheth is all that's left. And that's important. But he says, yeah, there is one. There's a son of Jonathan. Jonathan's sons are still alive. And unasked, David didn't say, well, tell me about his physical condition. Tell me about the way he is. But Ziba right away volunteers and says, but he is crippled in both feet. And the reason is that someone who was crippled like that in the society of the time, in that era, like this person was lesser. This person didn't fit in. They were not whole and complete. And so they were considered an outcast. They were the ones that didn't belong there. And so Ziba is kind of like, David, yeah, there is one, but I don't think you want him. He's crippled in both feet. He doesn't fit in. He's not, you know, like everyone else. He's, you know, an outcast. He doesn't. David, are you sure? And he invites him and says, I want to talk to him. Now, I'm going to just give you a backup a little bit here and catch you up on a little bit of backstory. But Jonathan and Saul are both killed in battle. And a couple chapters earlier, this story, we just kind of flew through. We didn't really talk about it. But it said Saul's son Jonathan had a son named Mephibosheth. So we've actually heard of Mephibosheth before if you took the time to read through 2 Samuel when you get to the chapter we're in today. But he said, who was crippled as a child. Here's the story. He was 5 years old when the report came from Jezreel that Saul and Jonathan had been killed in battle. So the king is dead. The heir to the throne, Jonathan, is dead. And the rumor has it that David is going to be the new king, which means that anyone related to Saul and Jonathan is as good as dead. And so it says here that when the child's nurse heard the news, she's his nanny, she picked him up and fled. And so we're talking fleeing here. Keep this in mind. Like, this isn't like, well, let me pack my bags and take my time and schedule something. No, she fled so quickly, but as she hurried away, she dropped him, and he became crippled. So the reason this boy was crippled to begin with is what we'll talk about in a moment, but he was crippled because she is fleeing, because she's afraid for the life of this child that she has sworn to protect, that she's been hired to protect. And she is running so quickly that she drops the boy, and he's crippled in both legs. And we don't know what that looks like or why, how the severity is, but it seems that, you know, well, you know that he's crippled. And so in this story, then, you've got Ziba saying to David, are you sure you want to invite this guy? He's an outcast. He doesn't fit in. He doesn't belong at the king's royal table. But David doesn't care because he's not showing merited favor. He's not showing you need to earn it kind of love. He is showing undeserved grace and says, bring Mephibosheth to me. Because I don't care if he's an outcast. He is invited to the table. The second thing that we see here is this seat. A seat for the empty. Are you empty? Do you feel like you've got nothing left? Because that's where Mephibosheth was. As we see, as we continue on in verses 4 to 5, he says, where is he, the king asked, in Lo Debar.
Ziba told him.
And all of you, nobody really knows what that means, you know, unless maybe you do. But Lo Debar, it literally means the place with no pasture. And if you lived in a community where livestock and farming, and you lived off of the land, this is basically, he's in the village of desolation. He's in a, not even village, he's in a place of desolation. There is nothing here. He is so afraid, he is so concerned, he has fled to where there's nothing. He has got nothing. He is in Lo Debar, the place with no pasture. And to us, we're like, oh, okay, so I'll just go over to the grocery store. No, no, no. That doesn't work in Mephibosheth's time. He is in a place of nothingness, of emptiness. He is here. That's where he lives, and literally and metaphorically. Like, he is living in a place of desolation. There's nothing there. And it says, at the home of Machir, son of Amiel, so David sent for him and brought him from Machir's home in Lo Debar. His name was Mephibosheth, and Jonathan, and he was Jonathan's son and Saul's grandson. So this second seat is a seat for the empty. And we're going to come back to this, but are you empty? Do you feel like, what's left? I've lost everything, and nothing's working right now. I've got nothing. Come to the table. You're invited to the king's table. There's a seat for you. Then the next thing we see about Mephibosheth is that there is a seat for the enemies. For the enemies. And maybe for you, you have been fighting God. You've been pushing back from what he wants for you. You have been avoiding giving yourself to him, whether that's in terms of just believing that Jesus died on the cross for your sins and giving you eternal life. Maybe that's just, you're at that point, but you're still kind of fighting against what God has for you. There's a seat for you because the enemies are invited to the table. And this is what we talked about already. Mephibosheth, he was the enemy because he could come forth and say, I hereby declare as the descendant of the king Saul that I am the right to the royal throne. I belong here. I am the next king. And so to David, now again, this is God's placement, but to David, Mephibosheth was the enemy. And I think it's really wild here, and we'll just read this, but again, we said he was crippled because he was running from the king right away, afraid of what was going to happen. But it says, when he came to David, he bowed low to the ground in deep respect. And you'll see later he bows again, but the words are different. Because the Hebrew word here, it's actually not a like, hey David, how you doing? The word means a violent fall. It's actually often used sometimes when you trip and fall and injure yourself. That Mephibosheth came before David and threw himself to the ground. Why? Because he thought he was being called in for his execution. This was an oh crap moment for Mephibosheth. I thought I'd been hiding. I thought I was able to be safe in Lo Debar, in the place of desolation. And now the king has found me. This is it. I'm dead. Because that's what kings do. That's the way it works. And so he is an enemy to the king. He throws himself violently to the ground in deep respect. And David, you know, greetings, Mephibosheth. How's it going down there? And Mephibosheth replied, I am your servant. What does David say? Don't be afraid. It's not with a period, it's with an exclamation point. Don't be afraid! You know, he knows, he's getting a sense of what's going on here. Mephibosheth is afraid for his life at this moment because he is David's enemy. He deserves to die. I mean, he doesn't deserve it, but you know what I'm saying? As the way things go, that's what happens. And so he throws himself down on the ground as the enemy of David. And David says, don't be afraid. I intend to show you undeserved grace, unmerited favor, loving, loyal love, chesed, kindness to you because of my promise to your father, Jonathan. I will give you all the property that once belonged to your grandfather Saul. So he's not only saying, I'm not going to kill you, but remember all that stuff that you had to run away from to this place of desolation? I'm giving it back to you because it's yours. It belongs to you. And again, a new king would come in and say, no, 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 I'm taking everything. says, I'm giving it back to you. It belongs to you. And then he says, and you will eat here with me at the king's table. You will be at my table. You thought you were the enemy, but he's been invited to the table. There's a seat for him. And he goes on and says, Mephibosheth bowed respectfully. This is different now. This is a, wow, I don't deserve this. And exclaimed, who is your servant that you should show such chesed, such undeserved grace to a dead dog like me? Because to him, this is it. This was the end. He's dead. Okay. Goodbye, Micah. Goodbye, people. King's invited me in. I'm going in to see the king. I will not come out. I love you. Goodbye. But instead, the king says, no, there's a seat for the enemies. You're invited to the table. You're the enemy, and it doesn't matter. I'm still showing you loyal love. I'm showing undeserved grace. Chesed. So then, the next seat we have is a seat for the failures. And maybe this is your seat. You just can't seem to get it right. Everything you do, you mess up. Or at least that's the way you perceive it. Nothing's working. And these seats, I mean, this is all the same person, right? Maybe it's similar to the emptiness. Maybe you're empty because you can't do anything right. You're a failure. And there's a seat here for the failures. He goes on then in verses 9 through 11. He says, and the king summoned Saul's servant Ziba and said, I have given your master's grandson everything that belonged to Saul and his family. Now understand, Mephibosheth, he is crippled in both feet. He is unable to walk. He is unable to do what a good Israelite man should do. And that is provide for his family, for his descendants. Work the fields, work the land so that you can provide. I mean, having sheep and land and pastures and all those things like that, all of that was part of what made value to the people. And Mephibosheth, he couldn't do that. And so in the eyes of everyone else, he's kind of a failure. You didn't do it. Like, come on, you had one job. Just provide for your family. And he couldn't do that. And so David says, you know what, that's okay, because there's a seat for the failures here, because you know what I'm going to do? He says, you and your sons, talking to Ziba, you and your sons and servants are to farm the land for him to produce food for your master's household. But Mephibosheth, your master's grandson, will eat here at my table. Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. Ziba replied, yes, my lord, the king, I am your servant, and I will do all that you have commanded. So he was invited to the table, even as a failure. And the king said, that's okay, because I'm going to provide for you. I'm going to give you what you need. I'm going to make you a success. Not because of what you've done, but because of my undeserved grace. And then there's one more seat at the table. And this is the seat for the lonely. And maybe this is you. Maybe you feel all alone. Maybe you feel like you've got no one. Maybe you feel like there's no one around you. No one cares. No one gets you. No one wants to even be near you. And it's easy for us to feel that way because we get inside our own heads. And man, I don't know about you. I am my own worst enemy. Don't give me too long to think. Because by the end, and I've shared this with you before, by the time I'm done, everybody hates me. And it's because of all the failures that I've made. And so I feel sort of empty. But a seat for the lonely. And what you need to remember here is that Mephibosheth, they said, is there anyone left? Is there any descendant? And they're like, well, there's a grandson. And that seems to imply that there isn't anybody else. Like here, this guy is alone. He's got a son, Micah. We don't know what else is there, so I'm not going to say that we can confirm that it's just Mephibosheth and Micah. I mean, if you know anything about biology, there's probably someone else involved there. But At this point, they say, this is it. This is the guy. He's alone. And for us, we're like, oh, that stinks. I mean, it's great to have my brother here. But, you know, we live 3 hours apart and we talk. But we are not in America today, we are not a society like Israel was, where family, like if you didn't have family and if you couldn't communicate or spend, like family was everything. You lived in your parents' house. I mean, it was this whole thing where family was everything. And Mephibosheth has got nothing. He is all by himself. And David says, that's okay. Because he's invited to the table. And this is what he says then. He says, then the king summoned, and from that time on, I got ahead of myself, Mephibosheth ate regularly at David's table. And I want you to understand that this translation doesn't do a very good job. Because the word regularly, at least to my mind, means every once in a while. You know, every now and then. But the word actually means always. From that time on, Mephibosheth ate always at David's table. There wasn't a time where it was like, hey, when you're in town, well, if I feel like it. No, you are sitting at my table. You are at my table. And what did that make him like? It made him like one of the king's own sons. So David said, Mephibosheth, look, you're not alone. And I know you feel like you've got nothing, but welcome to the table. And here your family. Here, we might not be related by blood, but you are part of the family now. You've been adopted as one of mine. And you are not alone. And do not forget that. Because he's been invited to the king's table. So it goes on, it says, Mephibosheth had a son named Micah. From then on, all the members of Ziba's household were Mephibosheth's servants. And Mephibosheth was crippled in both feet, lived in Jerusalem, and ate always at the king's table. What did Mephibosheth do to deserve that? Absolutely nothing. Nothing. What do we do? What can we do to be invited to sit at the king, not with a lowercase K, but a capital K? The King of Kings. Because we've been invited to the table too. The point this week, again, is that when you're after God, your life is marked by undeserved grace. And I don't know where you are right now. I do know that God, you know, we planned this series, 4 months ago? And God knew all the pieces. And God knew you were going to be here today. God knew you would be listening to this online, if you're listening to this online. And God knew that maybe you need to come to the table. Because Mephibosheth was invited to David's table, but you are also invited to the table. You are invited to the table. No matter where you are, no matter your situation, you are invited to come and sit not at King David's table, but at King Jesus' table. You have been invited to be a part of what he is doing. So let me ask you some questions. Do you feel like an outcast? Maybe this is your seat. I'm different. People don't get me. I screwed up, and these maybe run together. But I don't fit in. I don't belong. Why would Jesus accept me? Why would Jesus bring me to his table? But he does. You're invited to the table. You're invited to receive the grace as an outcast. In Luke chapter 14, Jesus is telling this story. He says there's this rich man who threw this huge banquet. And he said, I'm going to throw this big, amazing banquet. I'm going to have this incredible feast. And he says, he invited all of his friends. Hey, everybody, I'm going to have a feast. Here's the date. Save the date card was sent out. Don't miss it. Then the pre-invitations went out, because people do that now. Then like the reveal, of course, happened before. What's the party going to be like? That was happening too. Like there were multiple chances for everybody to get the invites. And the actual invitations came out like after 17 other invitations that actually came out. But, you know, whatever. I'm not judging. And he invites everybody. And all of a sudden, the people that were invited were like, oh, man, was that today? Like, I told you. Oh, I'm sorry. I got a new horse and I need to break it in. Oh, my kid's getting married. Okay, that's legit. And all of his friends came back and said, I can't make it. And so the story picks up here in verse 21 and says, the servant returned and told his master what they had said. The master was furious and said, go quickly into the streets and alleys in town of the town and invite the poor, the crippled, the blind, and the lame. Invite the outcasts. Those people would never be invited to a banquet in Jesus' time. He says, no, bring them all in. They belong to be here. And then said, after the servant had done this report, there's still room at the table. He says, then go out into the country lanes and behind the hedges. Because anybody live in the country, a hick, right? Bring in the hicks. And urge anyone you find to come. Even people that live in Belleville are invited to the king's table. we'll get to the enemies later. Cowboys fans. But the point is this. He's like, you know what? Everybody is invited. It doesn't matter how you see yourself. He says, this is the king's feast, and this is what the kingdom of heaven is like. And Jesus says, I've got a table here, and it's not about the rich and the polished and the perfect and the good and the nice. No, we're bringing in the outsiders, the outcasts, the people that would never be invited are welcome. So there's a seat for the outcast at the table. And if you are feeling like an outcast, it's time to come to the table. There's a seat for you here. Come to the table. Come to the table. There we go. Then the next question I have for you is, are you empty inside? I've got nothing. I'm in my own low debar, my own place of desolation. Nothing is working right now. Nothing is going right. I've lost everything that I've got. There's room at the table. You're invited to the table, even if you're empty inside, even if there's nothing in you, even if you feel like you've got no more. And we even alluded to this last week. You know, I think the saddest part for me when it comes to connecting with God, connecting with worship and church, is that when people in their low spots and the times when they need Jesus the most is the time they stop showing up. God would never accept me. I'm in this spot now. It doesn't matter. I don't want him. I'm going to walk away. I'm like, no, this is when you need it. But if you're empty inside, there is a seat at the table. In 2 Corinthians, Paul writes that he used to be Saul. God changed him. He became Paul and changed his heart. And it was pretty incredible. And he's planted tons of churches at this point. One of the churches being in Corinth. And in 2 Corinthians, actually in chapter 12, so hang on right there, he actually shares how he is empty. We're like, Paul, man, you wrote like half of the Bible, at least the New Testament. Technically, Luke wrote more than Paul, but anyway. He says, you're Paul, right? And this is what he says in chapter 11. He says, I have worked harder. He says, you think you're empty? You think there's no one who is accepting you? Here's my story. Here's my resume. I have worked harder. I've been put in prison more often, been whipped times without number, and faced death again and again. 5 different times, the Jewish leaders gave me 39 lashes. 3 times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. 3 times I was shipwrecked. Once I spent a whole night and day adrift at sea. I have traveled on many long journeys. I have faced danger from rivers and from robbers. I have faced danger from my own people, the Jews, as well as from the Gentiles. I have faced danger in the cities, in the deserts, and on the seas. I have faced danger from men who claim to be the believers, believers but are not. I have worked hard and long, enduring many sleepless nights. I have been hungry and thirsty and have often gone without food. I have shivered in the cold without enough clothes to keep me warm. And this is my favorite part as a pastor. He's like, and that's nothing. Then besides all of this, I have the daily burden of my concern for all the churches. Who is weak? You think you're weak without feeling my weakness? Who is led astray? And I do not burn with anger. He says, like, in addition to the physical things, my heart is breaking for the church. So he says, you think you're in an empty spot. I'm in an empty spot. And then the next chapter, he talks about how he is struggling through this. But he goes to God and says, God, help me fix this, make it better. And God's response is, my grace is sufficient for you. For my power is made perfect in your weakness. If you are empty, you are in a spot because suddenly God is going to be strong. When you have nothing, He will become everything. So empty isn't a bad spot. He goes on and says, therefore, I will boast more gladly about my weaknesses so that Christ's power may rest on me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, in difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong. Are you empty? Come to the table. Because then you're going to be made strong because your weakness is going to become Christ's strength in you. Come to the table. There's a seat for you. Next question. Have you been fighting God? Have you been pushing back from when you know what God wants to do in your life? That you know He's telling you to do something. He's leading you in a direction. He wants you to trust Him. He wants you to make a change. He wants you just to believe and accept His gift of undeserved love because He died on the cross for you. But you're fighting Him. You're pushing back. Jesus has invited you to His table. The one you're fighting against says, come to my table. You, as the enemy, are welcome. There is a seat for you. In Colossians 1, 21 to 22, this is what Paul writes to the church in Colossae. He says, this includes you. Yes, you. No, I would never be invited. I've been so far from God. I've been so far away from God. I'm not welcome at His table. No, this includes you who were once far away from God. You were His enemies, separated from Him by your evil thoughts and actions. Yet now He has reconciled you to Himself. Fancy word for saying He has invited you to His table. Not because of what you did, but in His through the death of Christ in His physical body. You didn't do it. You didn't earn it. He did it for you because you couldn't. As a result, He has brought you into His own presence. You are holy and blameless as you stand before Him without a single fault. If you have trusted in Jesus' death to take away your sin, then you are not being held back by your sin because Jesus says, I have taken that sin. I have suffered and died for it. Come to the table. And the next question. Do you feel like a failure? Can't seem to get it right? Doesn't seem like it's working out? Try to do the right thing. You think you try to do the right thing. And you keep failing. What's the point anyway? What's the use? I can't get it right. Why even try? There's a spot for you at the table. In Luke chapter 15, you probably are, if you grew up in church, you're probably familiar with this story. It's a parable that Jesus told, sharing about His Father's love for us. And He said there was this young guy who went to his dad and said, Dad, I know you're not dead yet, but can I have your money anyway? Don't miss that he's asking for an inheritance from someone that hasn't died. He says, Dad, can I have your money? And the father says, sure. And it says right away that the son left and squandered and wasted the money in wild living. He went crazy. He's like, I got the money, and he's going nuts with it. And he is just, he's not even going to like, maybe I should invest this. But he probably could have. There are probably plenty of good things to do. But the Bible is very clear that he wasted this money, this inheritance. And after the money ran out, after the fun was over, it says there was a famine in the land. He had to get a job feeding pigs. And there's this moment of brokenness for him where he's there feeding slop to the pigs, looking at the pig's slop, saying, man, I wish I was a pig because then I could eat their slop. He had wasted everything. He had failed. He had the money, he had the resources, he had the tools, and he lost it all. And he goes, this slop looks better than what I've got right now. And he has this idea. He's like, you know what? My dad's servants, not my dad's kids, not the family, but his servants, they actually eat. Dad feeds them. So I know what I'll do. I'll go back to Dad and say, Dad, look, I've ruined it. I've wasted it. I know. And I'm not talking to you as a son, but can I just be one of your servants? Can you hire me? Take me on. And then I could at least eat something. Didn't ask for anything fancy, and that was his plan. So then the verse picks up here in verse 20. It says, so he returned home to his father. And while he was still a long way off, his father saw him coming. Filled with love and compassion, he ran to his son. He ran to his son, embraced him, and kissed him. And his son started the speech. His son said, Father, I've sinned against both heaven and you. I'm no longer worthy of being called your son. Before he could finish it, but his father said, cut them off. Says to his servants, quick, bring the finest robe in the house and put it on him. Get a ring for his finger and sandals for his feet. And kill the calf we have been fattening. Because we must celebrate with the feast. For this son of mine was dead and is now returned to life. He was lost, but now he is found. So the party began. The father says, I don't care what you have wasted. I don't care about your failures. Come to the table so we can start the party. It doesn't matter. He's not saying, yeah, you can be one of my servants. He says, no, you're my son. And you are my son. And I've called you my son. And you will sit at the table with us. And we will party. Not because you are a perfect use of everything you've ever done. But because I'm not interested in failures. I'm a God that loves everyone. And you are welcome to the table. And maybe that's you. Are you the failure? It's time to come to the table. Stop sitting back and saying, God could never accept me. I've tried too many hard times. I've messed up. No. Father, reign. Father ran to the son and said, come on in, come to the table. And then finally, do you feel all alone? And again, I've said I'm my own worst enemy. I often feel like, wow, there's no one. And as Mephibosheth had no family, and David said, you're going to be one of the king's sons. You're going to be adopted. Jesus said the same thing to us. In Romans chapter 8, Paul writes this to the church in Rome. He says, so you have not received a spirit that makes you fearful slaves. Instead, you have received God's spirit when he adopted you as his own children. Now we call him Abba, which is an Aramaic word that means dad. Now we call him Abba, Father. For his spirit joins with our spirit to affirm that we are God's children. If you believe in what Jesus has done for you on the cross, you have been adopted into God's family. And maybe you actually are alone. Maybe there is literally no one around you. But you are a child of God, so therefore you are not alone. And frankly, you've got a family around you right now of brothers and sisters in Jesus. So you are not alone. And you might feel lonely, but it's time to come to the table and accept the fact that you're not alone. Do you feel like an outcast? Are you empty inside? Have you been fighting God? Do you feel like a failure? Do you feel all alone? Come to the table. You're welcome to sit at the King's table. Because when we're after God, our life is marked by undeserved grace. We don't deserve it. There's nothing that we deserve.